You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. We're talking about the midlife crisis of today. That's not what you might think it is. Today, someone in their 50s might be dealing with older parents that need care, but also adult children who have not quite become financially independent. And so today, middle age means dealing with serious and emotional and financial stress. Frank Inferna is associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University. He focuses on resilience in midlife and older adults, and he's the author of a recent piece for The Conversation titled "The Real Midlife Crisis Confronting Many Americans." Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You call the real midlife crisis today the big squeeze. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's really a combination of a lot of things. Most prominently, it's a period in which middle-aged adults are increasingly confronted with choices and emotional strain with their young adult children, but also dealing with aging parents, all while having, you know, dealing with their own health and potential financial strains as well. So it's just a combination of many factors.
Amy on Facebook shared with us she's dealing with her mom being in CBRF, community-based residential facilities, and she says, "My kid is in high school. I also have a second grader and working. It's beyond stressful, especially in the summers." That sounds like exactly the kind of stresses you're talking about.
Exactly. I mean, that's kind of, yeah, one of many ways, yeah, this is happening.
And share with us some of the many ways that middle-aged adults are feeling strained by care for their aging parents.
Well, I think it's just trying to develop a plan for how it is, you know, the care may be envisioned with our aging parents. I mean, having a plan in place and kind of thinking towards, or trying to have a plan in place and thinking towards the future, because this is, I feel like, just the beginning, because given the sheer number of baby boomers who are living longer and how by 2030 there will be more people age 65 and older in the U.S. Than people who are younger than age 18.
And those parents might be in a facility like Amy was sharing on Facebook. They might be living with their middle-aged children, or they may still be living on their own but needing a lot of support there. So it can take a lot of different forms, can't it?
Exactly. And just because, you know, your aging parent may be in a home, it doesn't mean that the stressors are gone. I mean, there are other stressors that arise. Are they getting the right and the type of care? Are their needs being met? And also the financial strain of it all. I mean, these homes are not cheap.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that, because I think sometimes people don't understand what gets paid for, say, by Medicare or even supplemental insurance, and what often is still, you know, the balance at the end of all that.
Well, I mean, in the article, I open with the vignette of, you know, what my parents and their situation with my grandma in a nursing home. And before going to the nursing home, she lived at home with my parents for a year and a half. And then they decided that she needed more care than they could really give her. And for the nursing home that she went into, she needed to pay 1 year out of pocket. So she had to have $100,000 in the bank to pay. And then once her money ran out, then Medicaid kicks in and foots the bill, as well as the remaining money you may get from Social Security and so forth. So out of pocket, I mean, it's at least $400 a day for, you know, nursing home costs.
Let's switch to the other side of this midlife stress, this midlife crisis, and that is having to or wanting to help adult children longer than maybe people expected to. What's going on with adult children today that is creating this double stress?
I think it's, for one, it may be prolonged educational attainment. So kids or young adults are attending college for longer, and depending on what type of industry you're in or what type of job you're looking for, the job market may be tepid. There may be not as many opportunities And so it's resorting to individuals having to live longer at home, which might have been unexpected.
So college might be taking longer. It's also more expensive. And also, if I'm doing my math correctly, the generation that was graduating at the end of the Great Recession is probably in their early 30s right now, somewhere around there. Have they fully recovered from coming out of college at that point?
From what I've been reading and seeing in the research, I mean, not as much as you had hoped. I think, college, like you had mentioned, it's expensive, and your kids are having to balance, you know, paying loans, whereas could they be saving to buy a house? They're having to really balance these different options. And if the loans are too high, then how can they realistically save enough to purchase a home? And this is, of course, depends on which where you're living. You know, housing prices definitely fluctuate depending on your geographic region.
We're talking with Frank Inferno right now. He's associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University. He focuses on resilience in midlife and in older adults, and he's the author of a recent piece for The Conversation titled "The Real Midlife Crisis Confronting Many Americans." And Frank, I think it would be easy to hear this conversation and think, well, this is nothing new. There's always been a generation in the middle that has kids and that has parents. So why is this an issue now? What are some of the factors that are different now than might have been for past generations?
You're right in that, right, this is something that's been, you know, happening for a while, but I think the sheer intensity of it and the magnitude that's transpiring right now, I think, you know, given the number of baby boomers that are 65 and older and entering this stage of their life, but also I think, you know, we think the economic recession of 2008, yeah, it happened 11 years ago, but I think the ramifications are still being felt, especially within the, for young adults trying to find employment and so forth.
And you are studying this, you're doing research right now. So far, what are you finding?
I think the biggest thing that really surprises is just the number of the midlife adults that are confronting these various different issues. So it wasn't just a smaller proportion, whether it be, you know, having to deal with and kind of how are they with their aging parents, you know, young adult children who are moving back at home, maybe oftentimes not even just them themselves, but bringing children home as well, and having to, you know, these increasing number of multi-generational households, I think adjusting to that emotionally, health-wise, and also financially.
And I think one of the interesting things going back to that Great Recession, which in some ways seems quite a while ago, but as you said, 11 years ago, all three of the generations that we're talking about were affected by that in different ways. And I think a lot of baby boomers, probably the parent age people, the older parent age people we're talking about, they might have ended up having to work longer because their retirement funds took a hit.
Absolutely. And I think that contributes also to, you know, young adults who may be having trouble finding employment is because you have these middle-aged adults who are having to work longer because retirement accounts were depleted and are, you know, starting to be replenished. But I think this certainly threw a wrench in people's retirement plans. If they were hoping to maybe retire, you know, in their early 60s, they are now having to delay this until their mid to late 60s.
We're talking with Frank Inferno. He's associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University, and he's with us to talk about what he says is the real midlife crisis today, that is middle-aged adults dealing with the emotional and financial strain of supporting both their aging parents and their adult children. And we really want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does this sound like something you're going through? Does it resonate with your experience? Are you caring for older parents? And are you also at the same time playing an active role in parenting your adult children? What has that been like for you? Has it been stressful? How are you dealing with it? Call in and tell us what the experience is like at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our discussion about the stresses felt by middle-aged people today. Frank Inferna is with us. He's an associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University, where he focuses on resilience in midlife and among older adults. And we hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. If you're middle-aged yourself, what has this period been like for you? Have you been dealing with stresses or burdens you didn't expect? Or have you had a different experience and maybe your midlife has been more enjoyable and easier than you thought it would be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Frank, this, as we said, is an age group that you study. Does it get as much attention as some other age groups do?
Historically, midlife has been understudied when looking at the history of psychology and developmental psychology. And one of the primary reasons why is because people in midlife are leading such busy lives, so balancing many roles, whether it be work, you know, having children, shuttling them around to practice or school, and then having, you know, with dealing with aging parents. I think historically it's just been difficult to, you know, get them to participate in a research study. That's primarily been one of the main reasons why.
And I think I read that what we're talking about when we talk about midlife is basically 40 to 65. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So historically, it feels like that is the age when maybe you had kids out of the house, but you're still actively working. But now that's kind of gotten thrown off with these adult children who still need a little support much later than maybe we used to expect.
Correct, right. There's this prolonged engagement in terms of parenting.
And is part of this perhaps that we've had an idealized image of what midlife was going to be like? Is it maybe that reality is just kind of catching up with us?
I think, yeah, it's a combination of things. I think originally, you know, whenever people talked about midlife in the research literature, it'd just be like, oh, the midlife crisis, you know, people are coming to terms with, you know, they're getting older and kind of seeing what's the next stage of their life is about. But it really didn't have much substance to it. And I think what I've been most interested in is kind of shedding light on what are these different factors that are really happening to individuals in midlife. And I guess I also want to emphasize, you know, this sort of new crisis that I'm talking about, it's not a blanket thing that's happening to everyone. You know, not every middle-aged adult is dealing with these sorts of issues, but there are, it depends on one's situation, one's own life, and whether or not these sorts of things are happening to them.
And actually, I can share that Pete on Facebook wrote, I'm 52, both my parents are deceased, and my 23-year-old daughter is a debt-free college grad with a great job in her own apartment. Midlife is good. So that's the other side of the coin.
Exactly. Yeah. So this isn't happening to everyone, but it's something that in terms of the sheer number of people who are experiencing these different sorts of issues, I think is certainly increasing.
We're talking with Frank Inferna. He's associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University. And we're talking about the new midlife crisis, which is taking care of aging parents while still providing support for adult children. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones. And Lisa in Madison is up. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I just want to say we have three generations in our family. We're taking care of my mother-in-law who's ill. And we have an adult children, one is in college, but one is disabled. And so we had to cut on our income because now my husband has to reduce his hours to take care of his mom. and we have additional expense for raising three families. And we're also hitting our pocket. We have to take out equity home.
I'm sorry, Lisa, we're losing you, but we got the gist. So what Lisa said, Frank, is really interesting and something that you highlighted. Often taking care of those parents especially can mean decreased income because someone has to work less or take a less demanding job.
Exactly. I think that's especially important to emphasize that, you know, having to reduce hours at work or maybe even taking a less demanding job because you're having to take care of your loved ones at home. And when thinking about it more broadly, you know, at the federal level, we don't really have a work-family policy in place that could help out in these sorts of situations. It's more so at the state level. And that's something, there was a recent report showing that there are six states in the District of Columbia that have work-family policies in place for these types of situations.
Let's go back to the phone, and Bonnie in Oshkosh is up next. Hello, Bonnie.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm presently, I'm 55 years old. I have been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis and Sjögren's syndrome. I am also taking care of my 79-year-old mother who has Lewy's body dementia. And my boyfriend is at his end of life, so I'm taking care of him as well. I'm working a full-time job.
And it sounds like that's a lot that you're dealing with. How has that affected you, Bonnie?
Well, I have had to put my health on back burner to make sure everybody else is okay, and I'm paying for it now.
Thank you so much for that, Bonnie, and I'm sorry that you're dealing with so much. Frank, that's another aspect we haven't touched on yet, the health of the people who are actually doing the caregiving and giving support to others.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, like Bonnie said, I mean, she's having to put her own health needs on the back burner to ensure she's able to take care of her mother and her boyfriend.
Let's go back to the phones, and Sharon in Madison's up. Hi, Sharon.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What would you like to share?
Good. Well, I just wanted to confirm kind of what Frank has said about hard situations. We've had, in our family, we've had some major transition. My mother, who is 95, moved out of her home that we've all lived in grew up in for 63 years. She's been in that home, and it was a hard knock for her to realize that she was not going to be able to live out her at the end of her days in this home. And then I myself, on top of that, just retired in April and made a major move of my own to Madison. And it's sort of been one not normal thing after another. And I mean, to the point where the last caller said something about putting her own health on hold. And I just today acknowledged that I really needed to talk to somebody about this. So I actually sought out a counselor and went and had a conversation today for the first time in my life ever. I'm 66. And she just was kind and said, you're going through a whole bunch of losses and transition. And she said, even though it's not a death, all of these things that you're going through are still fodder for grief. And she said, you have to let yourself go through that.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon. And I'm glad you're getting some help and support for yourself. Good luck with all of that. And Frank, every kind of change we go through throughout life is a stressor. And it sounds like what you're finding is that, just like Sharon was sharing, you know, it's stress upon stress upon stress.
Absolutely. Yeah, it almost, there's a accumulation or avalanche effect where one thing piles on top of one another to kind of brings people to this breaking point of, you know, how much can someone handle before, you know, their health significantly declines, or, you know, acknowledging and knowing that, okay, I need support and I need help. And what are ways that I can kind of seek this out?
We just heard from three women callers in a row, Frank. Do men and women experience midlife and the burdens that come with it differently?
Absolutely. You raise a really good point. Typically, women are disproportionately affected by this, by these changes. They're more likely to be taking on these caregiving roles when it comes to having to take care of their aging parents.
Frank, you've spent some time abroad in Germany. Are there things we can learn from other countries about how to make midlife easier?
Yes, I do. So before coming to Arizona State, I lived in Berlin, Germany for 2 years, and seeing the various policies that they have in place there. So one thing that sticks out prominently for me is when you have a child, you know, the each spouse, if they both take time off, they can share 14 months of paid time off at about 70% of their wages to, you know, adjust to having a child and get into a new routine and really in the early developmental stages of your child's life. And I was just there a couple of weeks ago and talking with my friends and colleagues there. They said, in terms of when having to take care of a loved one or an aging parent, there are similar types of policies in place. Not the amount of time off is not as extensive, but it's very similar setup as if you were having a child.
You mentioned earlier, Frank, that there are not federal policies currently that really support people with the stresses of midlife. They tend to be more state policies. Would having more consistent policies across states be useful?
I think it would definitely be useful. You know, and depending on the state, it could be up to currently the policies. It could be up to 12 weeks of paid time at about ranging from 50% to 80% of one's wages. And just having that sort of time to kind of adjust to a new living situation of if your aging parent is coming to live with you or if you're having to move them from elsewhere, if they're living in a different city. I think those sorts of policies and paid time off could really help relieve some of the burdens, not all of them, but would certainly help people adjust.
And we'll have to leave it there. Frank Inferna is an assistant professor of psychology at Arizona State University. He joined us to talk about the new midlife crisis, caring for aging parents and adult children. Coming up next, we'll find out about new kidney programs at the federal level. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins us to talk about why he's urging Congress to pass laws regulating a class of chemicals that are known to contaminate drinking water. First, President Trump recently signed an executive order that aims to improve access to care for people living with kidney disease.
I'm here to say we are fighting by your side and we're determined to get you the best treatment anywhere in the world. And we've made a lot of progress. We're with you every step of the way. In a few moments, I'll sign an executive order taking vital steps to increase the supply of kidney-available transplants.
In addition to making transplants more available, the goals of the order include kidney disease prevention and making in-home dialysis treatment more available. Dr. Dawn Wolfgram is a nephrologist at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's also Associate Professor of Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and is Section Chief of Nephrology at the Milwaukee VA Medical Center. Dr. Wolfgram, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
What are the main causes of kidney disease?
The main causes of kidney disease are high blood pressure or hypertension and diabetes mellitus. Those comprise probably almost 70% of kidney disease in the United States.
And the other 30% is a variety of things?
Yep, it's a variety of things. They can be genetically inherited disorders. They can be due to autoimmune diseases, sometimes due to kidney stone disease. So definitely a lot of different things can go into the other category.
Do we know how many people in Wisconsin have kidney disease?
So we do have estimates. About 15% of the United States population has kidney disease, and that would be pretty much the same prevalence you would see here in Wisconsin. Based on our population, that would be around maybe 800 to 900,000 people or Wisconsin residents. One thing that I did want to mention is that the awareness of kidney disease is still quite low. Back in, I think it was early 2010 or so, they did a national study looking at self-report of health health conditions, and only about 2% of the Wisconsin respondents reported having kidney disease. So you can see very few people reported having it compared to what we know is prevalent.
So there may be a pretty large number of people who are living with kidney disease but are not aware of it yet.
Exactly.
What are some of the most common treatment approaches for kidney disease?
So for early stages of kidney disease, really the treatment is geared at treating the underlying cause. So for high blood pressure, we try to control the blood pressure. For diabetes, you get your glucose under control. For the other diseases, you know, we treat autoimmune diseases and kidney stone disease, things like that. And so that's our treatment for, like I said, the early stages of kidney disease. Once you get more advanced kidney disease and you're looking at kidney failure, that's when you talk about what are called renal replacement options. And renal replacement options really boil down to transplant, dialysis, or just continuing medical management, which really is focused more than on symptom control and quality of life rather than sort of life prolonging.
I think most of us have heard the term dialysis, but I'm not sure that everyone's aware what that really does and what it entails. What does dialysis do to support or replace kidney function?
So what dialysis does is it uses a solution really to draw out excess toxins and basically metabolites that have accumulated in our body and extra fluid and gets rid of it like your kidneys would. Now, there's a couple forms of dialysis. The most common is hemodialysis, and that's where we take blood from the patient, it runs through the dialysis machine, goes through a filter, and then is returned to the patient. And that process happens at least three times a week for about 3 to 4 hours each time. That's done in center. Other forms of dialysis include home dialysis, where you can do peritoneal dialysis, and there we actually use the peritoneal cavity to infuse the dialysate, and it dwells there, sort of draws out those extra solutes and toxins, as I was mentioning before.
Can you explain what that cavity is for us?
Oh, the peritoneal cavity.
Yes.
So it's in your abdomen, and it's really just the space between your abdominal organs and your abdominal wall.
And one of the Trump administration's goals is to make that at-home dialysis available to more people. What does it entail to achieve that goal?
So really, in order to improve rates of home dialysis, we need to make sure we have patient education on that option and also support for the patients, because a lot of patients, you know, feel very wary about being in charge of their dialysis and actually doing it themselves, because that is what home dialysis usually entails. Either the patient themselves or a caregiver provides the dialysis at home. So we need to provide better patient education and support. And then we also need to make sure we have structure within our clinics and our dialysis units to have the nursing support to train these patients, to monitor these patients, the physicians to do that too, and really try to improve the ways we can offer it even outside the home. So like in other places such as nursing homes, things like that, where patients, well, you know, a lot of patients may be on dialysis.
What kind of equipment is involved in that at-home dialysis?
So there are two different at-home dialysis methods. So one is peritoneal dialysis, which I mentioned, and then the other is home hemodialysis. Both of them do require a dialysis machine. The peritoneal dialysis machine is pretty small. It would be the size of what you would think of being one of those not really used anymore PC towers, you know, mm-hmm. but can fit on a desk. And the main, space constraint is actually having room for the dialysate, because those are shipped out every 2 weeks and it's something that's used every night, about 10 liters or so. So you are having to store a lot of dialysate. The home hemodialysis machine is a little bit bigger, but it's still, you know, probably 3 to 4 feet tall, 1.5 foot wide type of thing. And there it comes with a different portable machine that actually reconstitutes the dialysate. So sometimes you don't have to have as much storage space for that.
We're talking with Dr. Dawn Wolfgram. She's a nephrologist at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin and an associate professor of medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin as well. We're talking about an executive order that President Trump signed recently that is aimed at helping people living with kidney disease. And, of course, there is also the option of a kidney transplant. How does someone qualify to receive a kidney?
So the kidney transplant evaluation process is pretty extensive. So in order to qualify for a kidney transplant, one, you have to be physically fit to undergo the surgery because we do not want to have patients undergo surgery that might be too high risk for them and then they suffer complications such as cardiovascular events or something during that surgery time. The other is that you need to have the ability or have the support to manage a complex medical regimen. Transplant requires lifelong medications afterwards, very intensive follow-up in the peritransplant period and followed by, you know, pretty routine surveillance to make sure they're catching any signs of rejection or problems that might be occurring. So you have to have, you know, good compliance with medical care, be able to manage those medications, be healthy enough to undergo the surgery for transplant. And basically, those are the things we evaluate when we decide if somebody is eligible for a kidney transplant.
And how available are kidneys for people who need them?
So right now, there is a wait list for kidney transplants. Nationwide, it's about 94,000, and there's about 20,000 kidneys done in a year. And so you can see that the number of kidney transplants is much less than the wait list, and it's also less than the number of kidneys transplant people that are added to the wait list each year. In Wisconsin, we have about 1,500 people on our wait list. We do about 400 transplants per year, and about 500 people are added to the wait list per year. So you can see definitely there is a scarcity of available organs for our waitlisted people.
This executive order that President Trump signed, one of the goals of it is to increase the number of kidneys that are available. What are they proposing to bring those numbers more in balance?
So to increase the access to kidney transplant, their goal is, you know, is quite aspirational. They want to double the number of kidneys available for transplant by the year 2030. And there's two ways they want to go about that. One is they want to increase utilization of available organs, specifically from deceased donors. And so that means that there are organs procured, and about 18% of those organs are not used in transplant. They're discarded. And they can be discarded for a number of reasons, including medical reasons. But what they're trying to do is figure out ways to make sure that organ procurement organizations are still considering these organs as potentials and have enough education to make that decision. And they're also trying to think about, you know, more use of virally infected deceased donors. So patients who have hepatitis C, you know, 10 years ago, hepatitis C was, you know, very hard to treat. It was a difficult treatment and very poor cure rates. But now that has really turned around with new therapies, and it's essentially curable with our current therapy. And so if we can use those kidneys, you know, that can increase our available organ supply. Kidneys from donors who have hepatitis C are actually growing right now because of the opioid epidemic.
Mm-hmm. And they also want to make it easier for people living donors to donate kidneys.
Right. So that's the second part of the increasing access to transplant is increase the number of living donors. And so what they want to do is they want to remove disincentives to donations and ensure adequate financial support. So one thing they're trying to do is expand the reimbursement of travel and subsistence expenses toward living organ donation. They're trying to do that sort of by increasing the income threshold that is needed for that, so more people would qualify. They're also looking to provide reimbursement for lost wages up to $5,000.
And briefly, before we let you go, what should we all know about keeping our kidneys healthy?
So as I mentioned at the beginning, the leading cause of kidney disease here in the United States is diabetes and high blood pressure. And both of those are preventable and treatable. So making sure you adopt healthy lifestyle that reduce the risk of those conditions, you know, maintaining a healthy weight, diet low in processed foods, incorporating regular activity, not smoking, just in general, taking care of yourself will prevent those diseases and then prevent the complications of them, including kidney disease.
Well, Dr. Wolfgram, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Dawn Wolfgram is a nephrologist at Fredert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about the new federal directives on kidney disease prevention and treatment. Coming up, we'll talk to Attorney General Josh Call about a letter he signed, along with 21 other state attorneys general, urging Congress to act on a group of chemicals that pose a danger to groundwater. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk to an economist and opinion writer who says that the way the United States pays for our roadways is not very efficient and could present problems in the long term. First, attorneys general across the country have signed a letter strongly urging Congress to pass laws to mitigate potential issues associated with per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, better known as PFAS. These are a class of more than 3,000 human-made chemicals. They're found in a range of products, including Teflon-coated pans. Here in Wisconsin, your introduction to PFAS might have come from the news that firefighting foam being tested by Johnson Controls had seeped into the groundwater in Marinette over a period of several decades. Attorney General Josh Call joins us now to talk about the letter and what the coalition of 22 attorneys general want Congress to do about PFAS. Attorney General Call, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you want to sign this letter on behalf of Wisconsin?
There are a couple of reasons. One is the science on PFAS is still emerging, and this is a threat that I think a lot of people were not aware of until quite recently. And making sure that there's public attention to this issue and to the importance of taking action to make sure that our water is clean and that if there is PFAS contamination that we're taking action to address it, I think is really important. And then secondly, the federal government has the opportunity to take some action here that will help remediate some of the problems that have stemmed from the use of PFAS. And so there are really sort of three different categories of action that we're asking the federal government to take. One is to take certain steps that will lead to more cleanup efforts so that more resources can be put into cleanup. Second, we want to make sure that there's more information provided to the public through sampling and through more notice about when there are releases of PFAS. And then third, we want to make sure that screening is available for people who may have been exposed and may need medical treatment as a result.
So a lot that you're looking at, what exactly would you and the other attorneys general like to see come directly from Congress on this issue?
So one of the things we'd like to see a change is that under CERCLA, a federal environmental law, we would like to see some PFAS substances designated as hazardous substances. If that happens, that would both, we think, spur more cleanup in the area of military bases. It would also lead to more disclosure of information about when PFAS is released. We'd also like to see funding from the federal level to help fund cleanup efforts in states around the country, including in Wisconsin. And then we think the federal government should play a role when it comes to those screening efforts as well. You know, there also needs to be action at the state level, and that's an important component of our response to this too. But making sure that the federal government takes action sooner rather than later is important from my perspective, because you know, making sure that our groundwater is safe and that people have access to safe and clean drinking water is vital for not only for our health but also for our economy and for our quality of life in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call. He and 21 other states' attorney general have signed onto a letter asking Congress to address the issue of PFAS. And this is a request to the federal level. What currently is already being done at the state level here in Wisconsin on this issue?
So Governor Evers recently announced proposed limits for relating to PFAS, and the proposed rulemaking process takes some time, but that would create a standard, and if the levels were above that standard, it would lead to certain actions being taken. So I'm hopeful to see that move forward so that we have clear guidance for communities around the state as to what levels of PFAS are safe and at what level they need to take action. And then at the Department of Justice, when there are serious violations of our environmental law, whether they relate to PFAS or to any other environmental issue. We're committed to taking action to enforce our environmental laws.
I think that's an interesting point because on this issue, someone might expect that it would be the Department of Natural Resources or maybe the department that deals with public health that would be dealing with this, but you are the Department of Justice.
That's right. We play a role, and DNR and Department of Health Services certainly play a role as well. It's the Department of Health Services that did an assessment of what levels create a health risk, and DNR is the agency that's proposed the rules. And DNR does the sort of initial enforcement and investigation into any potential violations. But in cases involving serious violations where the state wants to bring a significant enforcement action, those cases go to the Department of Justice.
I don't think anyone would argue that bipartisan efforts are fairly rare these days, but you are a Democrat working with other Democratic but also Republican attorneys general across the nation. How widespread is this issue in the U.S., and how is it that, you know, everyone, regardless of party, is coming together on it?
This is an issue that impacts every state, and it impacts communities across the country. Clean, safe drinking water, and PFAS, unfortunately, has impacted many communities. I believe that all the AGs who signed on to this particular letter are Democratic AGs, but I think that this is an area where there should be broad bipartisan consensus. Governor Evers has declared this the year of clean drinking water in Wisconsin. And Speaker Voss has a task force that's dedicated to clean water. But what I want to see is not just a commitment in principle to working for clean water, but also some concrete steps that are going to help make our water cleaner. And that's going to include likely some policy development through rules, potentially legislation, and having the kind of funding that our Department of Natural Resource investigators need and that our Department of Justice need to enforce our environmental laws. Is going to help us keep our water safe as well.
It was announced today, according to the Biz Times Milwaukee, that Johnson Controls has set aside $140 million to help clean up the contamination from that firefighting foam seepage that we talked about. Do you think that goes far enough?
So I don't want to comment on specific matters related to Johnson Controls because I don't want to comment on any potential litigation. But I will say that this is an issue that has, it's, as you mentioned, firefighting foam is one of the products that contains PFAS. And so making sure that there is significant, that there are significant resources available to fund cleanup efforts is going to be part of addressing this problem. And what resources are going to be needed and from whom will depend on, to what extent there's groundwater contamination that's resulted from runoff, and also to what extent particular companies or manufacturers are responsible for producing PFAS that's ended up in water.
Attorney General Call, if the federal government opts not to pursue something nationwide, not to take action, as you and the other state attorneys general are asking, what kind of situation does that put state governments in?
Make it much more difficult to address the cleanup issue in particular, because having federal government resources addressing cleanup is important. You know, another issue is that a lot of the facilities where firefighting foam has been used are military facilities. So in a lot of cases, this is federal property, and having the federal government participate in those cleanup efforts is particularly important with respect to PFAS, given how much of the contamination has resulted from activity on federal lands. So it would leave the states with much less ability to address this problem. So it's important that the federal government steps up and plays a role here, too.
And briefly, what is the next step that you'll be watching for? Do you know when you might get any kind of response?
We'll see. I know that there's legislation pending in Congress, and as I said, part of the goal of the legislation was to, or of this letter was to encourage the legislation to move forward. But unfortunately, we've seen increasing numbers of stories about contamination from PFAS in different water systems here in Wisconsin, but also around the country.
And we'll have to leave it there. Attorney General Josh Call, thanks so much for joining us today. Attorney General Call joined us to talk about the bipartisan effort from attorneys general across the country urging Congress to act on a class of chemicals known as PFAS. Whether it's getting inspired to Marie Kondo your house, or your parents or your spouse ask you to get rid of some of your junk, apparently cleaning out storage areas can be pretty lucrative. Ideas Network producer Chris Molina is with me in the studio. Chris, what's this story about someone finding a valuable video game?
Yeah, so there was a guy who had been asked by his mom to clean out some of the stuff in his childhood bedroom.
And this is an adult.
An adult, yeah. And we've all been there, you know, stuff that just piles up. And it turns out he found a copy. It was an unopened, sealed copy of a Nintendo Entertainment System game called Kid Icarus. And it turns out that this thing is worth a lot of money. He thought, you know, maybe it's worth a little bit. He said he had it on his kitchen counter in reach of his kids. Turns out it's worth $10,000. It's expected to hit the auction market here pretty soon. And it sounds like this guy's going to have a good payday.
And I thought it was really funny. Someone from the auction house that I believe is handling the auction where this will be put up for sale said, to find a sealed copy, quote, in the wild.
Yeah.
Which, you know, some childhood bedrooms are in the wild.
I love that phrase. And also, you know, I have a small collection of old video games. I used to kind of collect some of them. Nothing like this. And when I was a kid, when I had these games, I threw the boxes away.
Yep.
So, sorry, future children, I can't pay for your college now.
There goes your retirement.
Exactly, too. Yeah.
Well, maybe you'll find one.
Check your attic.
Exactly.
You know, who knows what you have sitting there.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.